62 years ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington and delivered his immortal I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Good afternoon and welcome to this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is Dr. Jean Theo Harris, a historian and distinguished professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the author or co-author of 13 books on the civil rights movement. Her latest book makes the case that some of Dr. King's most significant work in his fight for racial justice wasn't in the Jim Crow South, as legend has it, but rather in cities like Boston, Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles. She argues that despite his role in passing landmark civil rights legislation and the professed support he received from white liberals in the North, King was consistently betrayed by those whites, the press, and the federal government. The book is called King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside of the South. Jean Theo Harris joined me on Zoom from New York last April. Jean, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you write that it's easier to claim to love King than to listen to him. When we're not listening, what are we missing?
We are missing so much. Just to give you a couple of examples. From the beginning of Montgomery, in his first book, Stride Towards Freedom, at an Urban League anniversary celebration in the early 1960s, King is calling for a Northern liberalism that is actually liberal at home, that responds with outrage, not just about what's happening in Mississippi or Alabama, but when someone is denied a job, when someone can't move into your neighborhood. So that's one of the things we're not listening to. Another thing, on Easter weekend, 1962, Dr. King from the pulpit of Ebenezer Baptist Church says, "We have known our Good Fridays because of our experiences with police brutality." Dr. King comparing Jesus's time on the cross with police brutality. Again, a quote we're not so familiar with. Many of us are familiar with the letter from a Birmingham jail where he talks about the danger of the white moderate, the white moderate who prefers order to justice. The next year, he goes a step farther. He's talking about a protest planned for the New York World's Fair. Brooklyn Core is going to stall their cars on the opening day of the World's Fair to underline the level of injustice and inequality in the city. Moderates are outraged. They want King to denounce it. King refuses. And he basically says, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, "I've heard a lot of talk about how our direct action, you know, alienates our friends. If our direct action alienates our friends," and this is a direct quote, "they never were really our friends." And so the kind of calling in and calling out Northern allies, Northern liberals, I think is one thing. I mean, I could go on forever.
Yeah. I mean, it's because you write about, you know, Northern liberals, as you say, applauding his work in the South. But when it came to actually, deconstructing systemic racism in the North, they were much less inclined to help. It seems to me that there's two aspects about this book that sort of set it apart and are worth noting. The first is that his actions in the North have gotten less attention, perhaps, from historians.
Markedly less attention.
Know, than what he did in the South. And because of that, we lack appreciation of their significance. And the second is the role of Coretta Scott King as an advisor, as a philosophical soulmate, and as a person who was just much more than the wife taking care of the kids back mm-hmm. home. Mm-hmm. So let's begin by, first of all, when you say the North, mm-hmm. what do you mean? Because it's not actually geographically all in what we consider the North.
Right. So when I use the North, I'm following Dr. King and many Black activists of the time. And the North was a shorthand for everything that is not the South, and every part of the country that, in fact, took pride and often use that in this period to say we are not the South. And so what we are talking about is the Northeast, the Midwest, and the West is all the North. And I think Dr. King uses that. I think many Black activists at the time use that because many people outside the South are very proudly asserting, we're not the South. We're open, we're free, we're fair. And so the use of the North, and obviously it harkens back to the sort of Civil War and this idea that the North is some sort of promised land, escape from the South. And Dr. King will call it, to use his phrasing, a new Egypt, where the pharaohs are more sophisticated. That's one of the things he says. And so I think when we're talking about the North here today, we are talking about everything from LA and Arizona to, you know, my hometown of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Chicago and Detroit, to Boston, New York, Philadelphia, DC.
All right. And he traveled an amazing amount of miles. You write that he charted 6 million miles in between 1957 and 1968. Yeah. And he was asked by people on the West Coast and in the Midwest and in the Northeast to get involved. And in that decade between Montgomery bus boycott, which is 1955, and the uprising in Watts in L.A., he was in Southern California like 15 different times. I mean, that's a lot of trips to L.A. That's a long way to go from, you know, Montgomery or Atlanta, wherever he was.
Absolutely.
So he really was committed to this. How do you describe the difference between the racism of the South and the racism of the North?
So I think we first want to remember, and again, it took me doing this project. I think one of the things about this book and this project is what it means to ask a different question, and it's a kaleidoscope. So you turn that kaleidoscope and a whole set of patterns and colors come into view. And so I want us actually to start with Dr. King's time in school, in graduate school, because I think many of us know that Dr. King goes to seminary in Pennsylvania, Crozier Seminary, and then he goes to Boston to get his PhD. But
both
most of
predominantly white institutions.
Predominantly white institutions in predominantly segregated towns and cities. But I say that even though most of the way that Dr. King's time in seminary and BU are written about is about his intellectual influences, what he's learning, what his ideas are. Those are incredibly important. But what we have not really looked at enough and sat with enough is what it means to be Dr. King in his own body as a Black, young Black man in these spaces, in predominantly white institutions, right? He's one of six Black graduate students at Crozier in a predominantly white institution. All of the faculty are white. One of the most sort of early experiences, what he will call his first sit-in, happens in 1950. He and some friends have gone out for a drink in New Jersey, right across from where Crozier is, in Maple Shade, New Jersey. The owner refuses to serve them. New Jersey has a new anti-discrimination law in the books. Dr. King, who's not Dr. King, Martin Luther King, cites that, his friends cite that. The owner's like, I don't care. Says no. They try again. The owner gets his gun and kicks them out at gunpoint. Okay. But what might be the most kind of haunting or traumatic part of this experience will happen next. So Dr. King is outraged. He goes to talk to a mentor, and then he gets the help of the local NAACP leader whose daughter actually is going to the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And so she gets three white friends to go test the bar just to make sure that they are served on a Sunday. They are served. Originally, they are willing to come forward. And then when push comes to shove, when King and his friends decide to file this suit, these white students disappear. Their parents get nervous about what it will do to their reputations, and they refuse to testify. And so the case goes nowhere. So I think looking at that experience, many, many biographers of Dr. King cite a traumatic experience he has when he's 15 years old, when he's coming back from a speaking contest and he's made to stand on the bus. And that is a very traumatic experience for him. But I would argue this experience in Maple Shade is equally traumatic. It shows both that the kind of segregation, even if there's a law, is still there. And it shows that people who say they're your friends, often when it might cost something, refuse to side with you. So this, again, this is a 21-year-old Martin Luther King.
Yeah. And, you know, you even assert that Northern white liberals, including politicians, journalists, residents, actually comprise some of the most difficult opposition that King ever faced. I mean, for all the Bull Connors in the world, there were a whole lot more people in the North. And you write that Northern racism was harder to challenge. I wonder why that is, because on its face, you might think, well, at least in the North, there were some people who were sympathetic, certainly more, you know, per thousand people than in the South. Why would it be harder to challenge?
I think a couple of reasons. I mean, what Dr. King said, many white people in the North liked it as long as I was safe from them down South. So I want to tell you a story about Chicago, right? Chicago has an incredibly robust school desegregation movement, right? Parents all across the country, right, are heartened by Brown and see the Supreme Court's decision in Brown in 1954 as the potential to really change their schools. Now, what's happening in Chicago is that segregation is getting even worse. That's partly due to Black migration over the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. The Board of Ed is vociferously zoning so that Black students are trapped in Black schools. Those schools get so overcrowded that many of those schools, the Board of Ed puts on a double session day. And this is true of other northern school districts. So this is not just a Chicago problem. What that means is that the school day is cut in half. So some students go in the morning and then a whole second set come in the afternoon. You can imagine parents are outraged. They start to, again, so that they don't have to rezone to bring Black students into like empty seats in predominantly white schools. They then start to buy trailers and put classrooms and parking lots in these schools. So there's a very robust movement in Chicago in the early 60s that King is supporting. There's a big school boycott in October of 1963 in Chicago with the numbers equaling the March on Washington. So there's this relentless activism in Chicago. King will say if it had happened somewhere in the South, there would have been change. Now, what we know, right, is the Civil Rights Act passes in 1964. And one of the things that the Civil Rights Act does is it ties federal funding of schools to desegregation. So guess what those Chicago parents and activists think? They're like, hey, we have a Civil Rights Act. And so using the process, they file a complaint with what is then Housing, Education, and Welfare, the Department of Housing, Education, and Welfare, saying, look, we have segregation here. And Hugh looks, and they ask the Chicago Board of Ed for information like class size and teacher placement, and the Board of Ed refuses. And so on October 1st, 1965, Hugh makes the decision to hold $32 million for Chicago public schools because of their segregation. And guess what happens? White Chicago goes insane. Mayor Daley, white parents, the Chicago Tribune, Chicago's congressman who had voted for the Civil Rights Act. And Daley is so mad, he gets on a plane to confront Johnson himself a couple days later. And guess what happens?
That's President Johnson we're talking about.
That's President. Right. Thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited to tell you my story. I forgot to say it's President Johnson. President Johnson, our big champion of the Civil Rights Act. And less than a week after Hugh held that money, Johnson orders them to disperse it. And that is the end of enforcement against northern school districts of the Civil Rights Act. I think one of the things that we... To your question, I wanted to tell this story because I think it gets at one of the things that is hard, which is those same congressmen who voted for the Civil Rights Act, that same president who signed the Civil Rights Act, when it comes to enforcing it in Chicago, They won't. Now, let me give you one more example. As you may know, for the people listening, the Kings will move to Chicago in January to escalate that campaign in Chicago. But they do not move the children because the Kings, Coretta has been able to get the two oldest kids into a desegregating, very good public school in Atlanta, because guess what? The federal government is overseeing Atlanta. So in effect, the Kings can get their kids into a school in the fall of 1964 in Atlanta that they cannot get into in Chicago. And so I think part of the question is enforcement. And what, again, if we go back to a liberalism that's liberal at home, what King is calling on people to do, and this is a thing that ministers often call on their congregation to do, is to like walk the talk, right? To be willing to do it at home.
Jean Theo Harris, the book is called King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside the South. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll have more with Jean Theo Harris on the other side. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back to this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're listening to a conversation I had in the spring of 2025 with the civil rights historian Jean Theo Harris about her most recent book, King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside of the South. Dr. Theo Harris is a distinguished professor at Brooklyn College in New York. She has published extensively on the civil rights and black power movements and the politics of race and education. Her book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, was made into a Peabody Award-winning documentary that's available to stream on Peacock. In King of the North, Theo Harris makes the case that Dr. King's work in the North, Midwest, and West is as important, or perhaps even more important, than the work he did in his native South. Because our conversation was pre-recorded, we can't take any new calls or comments today. So, Jean, picking up on Chicago again, you mentioned that they announced this campaign in April of 1965. They moved up there a few months later, and this was by no means widely accepted, even within King's own circle. There were plenty of people who thought this was a terrible idea. Roy Wilkins, Thurgood Marshall, they thought it was an unnecessary diversion from the real work of desegregating the South. You mentioned that at one mass meeting, there were young black men who booed King. And that was the first time, the only time that King pointed to in which black men had booed him. And then, of course, there was all sorts of violence, in Chicago later on. And following that violence, Richard Daley was reelected by a landslide in 1967. And we had the Democratic National Convention, et cetera. And those stories are famous. But he talked about the vitriol and hatred in the North, unlike anything he had seen in the South. He singled out Chicago and Cicero, Illinois, which was a place he got hit in the face with a brick, as being just the worst expression of violent racism that he had ever experienced. So this is a guy who'd been arrested 29 times.
Yeah, so I think there are kind of a couple of different aspects of kind of Chicago's extraordinary racism that really get to Dr. King. So when they move there in January of 1966, they move into an apartment in what is, Chicago has basically two kind of black ghettos at this point, the South Side, which is an older neighborhood, and then the newer ghetto is on the West Side. And when I'm using the word ghetto, and when King uses the word ghetto, it is to like underline that housing, schools, municipal services, all of these are segregated and constrain black life. And by 1965, King is going to be using the frame of domestic colonialism to talk about the experience of black people in cities like Chicago, LA, and Harlem. And what he means by that is a couple of things. One, that people that people from the outside have the jobs, and from teachers to garbage. So the jobs are going to other people. People are profiting off of Black misery. Second, he's talking about the role of the criminal legal system. So he's talking about both the police and courts as enforcers of this kind of segregation and immiseration. Third, he will talk about the role of elevating certain Black faces to high places. And in Chicago, he will call this a kind of plantation politics, because a number of Black politicians then are just loyal to Daley and not to kind of their Black constituents. So I think he encounters kind of two different forms of kind of extraordinary racism. One is the kind of racism and the kind of conditions that are being allowed in, for instance, the West Side ghetto. Now we want to remember, Chicago has some of the most sort of developed building codes in the nation by this point, but they're not being enforced at all except politically. So as they began to do things like rent strikes and tenant organizing on buildings that have dozens of code violations that are just not enforced, one thing that just guts Dr. King, a couple weeks after they move into this apartment, a baby, a one-year-old baby, is basically chewed to death by rats. That baby is also malnourished. His name is Andre Adams. Dr. King will call this as much of a civil rights tragedy as the death of Viola Liozzo after the Selma to Montgomery march the previous spring. Okay, so the level of what people are having to live under, no heat, like rats in people's living in people's apartments, like no sanitation, no adequate sanitation. So that level of racism and negligence by the city.
Yeah, and of course, they fixed up the building that Mr. and Mrs. King were living in. And there were even people who joked, if he could just move from one tenement to another, they'd fix up all the buildings in Chicago.
Right, because I think what it shows is that with the will, with the feeling that somebody's going to look at it, that they can be fixed, right? And this is part of what was galling to King, right? Was that it was possible, and many of his neighbors in that building were so glad, because then the heat worked, right? Some of and again, this is Chicago before global warming, right? So this is a Chicago winter, and many people are living without heat, without the furnace working. So the second is, so they're working on housing segregation in two ways. One is really trying to attack the conditions, and again, doing a lot of like tenant organizing, working with, doing rent strikes, like I said. Then also, what we have in Chicago are what we would call sundown towns or sundown neighborhoods, neighborhoods where there are almost no, if or no Black people living there. Mayor Daley lives in one called Bridgeport. In fact, when two students, Black students, try to move into that neighborhood in the 1960s, Mayor Daley's neighbors, basically forced them out. And then in 1964, when the movement marches on Daley's house and his neighbors throw rocks and bottles, Daley has not his neighbors arrested, but the marchers. And he calls his neighbors very fine people. Okay, so the second thing they're going to do is they're going to start to also basically march into these sundown towns and sundown neighborhoods. And one thing, really very important thing, happens in May that really pushes this forward, which is that a 17-year-old by the name of Jerome Huey, a Black teenager, goes for a job interview in Cicero. Cicero is a sundown town. That means Black people can work there, but they're not safe there after dark. And he is basically beaten to death as he waits for a bus after his job interview. And this is gutting, right? This is 1966. This is 11 years after Emmett Till.
In the north, right,
In the north,
in
in
Chicago.
Chicago.
Yeah.
In a Chicago where, let's just remember, President Johnson in 1966 has introduced a new Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, which was
One of the
defeated
things,
ultimately,
it's
unfortunately, but
ultimately defeated.
yeah.
But like this violence, and then the violence against, so they will start to have open housing marches into these all-white neighborhoods that are very close to where the Kings are living, Marquette Park, Gage Park. And like you said, Tom, the violence is, I mean, Andy Young, King's lieutenant, will say it's worse. The mobs are bigger than what they'd encountered in the South. Thousands of people, women, children, families coming out of their houses. But I think the other thing that is significant about the violence is the way the nation reacts. Because what we know happens, right, with the violence on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965, is the nation says, no, this is not okay. The violence in the summer of 1966, the marchers get blamed. They're causing trouble. They're the problem. Vice President Humphrey, even President Johnson implies this. So I think part of the racism is also the unwillingness to call it for what it is. And I think that is devastating. So I think there's a myth that King or the movement fails. And I think that's a convenient myth because it means we don't reckon with what happened, which is that the nation failed.
The book is called King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside the South. The author is my guest, Jean Theo Harris. Jean, I want to switch our topic now to the press and how the press covered things in the North differently than they covered things in the South. When you talk about how the nation reacts, it's because, you know, largely for people who were not living in those particular cities, what they read. The New York Times, you said, increasingly, you know, provided very serious coverage about what was going on in the South. But when the activism about civil rights got closer to home, they became much less rigorous in their coverage. They ran an article worrying about black violence in the North. All of a sudden, we're talking about cultural pathologies all the time rather than the systemic conditions that created this. You mentioned in particular that when it came to the FBI, who were surveilling Dr. King and leaking what they were finding to the press, people have given the press great credit for not printing that stuff. But you take it a step further and say they had another option, which they also didn't take. What was that?
Well, I mean, they could have said, so just to, they're leaking salacious material. They're leaking, you know, the FBI is trying to get negative stories printed about Dr. King in all different ways possible. And we want to remember that the FBI and the Kennedy administration become increasingly concerned about King after the March on Washington. That's when the FBI calls him a demagogue. That's when Robert F. Kennedy signs off on a wall-to-wall surveillance of King. Okay, so part of what they, so they're trying to give salacious material to reporters. Those reporters don't publish it. And many scholars give them a lot of credit for that. But what they also could have done is say, look, the FBI is massively surveilling, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King, Nobel Peace Prize winner, Dr. King. They do not do that. And in fact, sometimes they cast doubt when activists in this period are saying that this is happening. They put it as a question, even though many of these reporters have seen with their very eyes. So yes, that press had a different option. I mean, I think going back to what you were saying before, part of the genesis of this book, right, begins with kind of looking at the black press and seeing a story about Dr. King and about kind of his work and support in the North, right? And like that was not in most books on Dr. King, and then trying to figure out why and realizing that the kind of arc of the story that we often tell, right, which is this kind of Montgomery to Selma and the kind of, you know, this final success with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and then Watts erupts. And that's when Dr. King discovers the North. And then he tries Chicago and it fails, right? So it's this kind of both this declension, but also this like revelation. And as you said, Tom, like King has been in LA more than 15 times before the Watts uprising, and he's been standing with movements in LA much of that time around police brutality, around schools, around housing. But the way it's being covered in the press, that arc of the story of like King like erasing or minimizing or dismissing that work in the North before 1965. Then there's this big wake up and shock by newspapers from the LA Times to the New York Times about Watts. So that story of King that we get, that we are often taught, is a story that the media is telling at the time. And so what it took to kind of tell this other story was to get to kind of both take that story apart, but also to kind of start in the black press. And you see a much different story if you start in the black press.
And of course, the black press was the only place that had any black reporters. You know, you remind us that the LA Times before the Watts uprising had zero black
Zero.
reporters, and almost all the major dailies had zero or no, you know, just a few.
Right. Yes.
So that's, you know, certainly a big part of the story. And in terms of politics, the other narrative that we're used to hearing is that there was something of a rivalry and a disagreement, for example, between Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. And you say that the differences there were not particularly acute, that they were much more kindred in their political philosophy than has been reported. What makes you come to that conclusion?
I think if you look at what movements Dr. King is supporting, from the West Coast to the Northeast, and you look at the movements that Malcolm X is supporting, and we want to remember, Malcolm X also, because he's in the Nation of Islam, is not Elijah Muhammad is kind of restricting some of what Malcolm X can participate in, but he's trying, right? So, for instance, in 1962, the unarmed secretary of the mosque in LA, Ronald Stokes, is killed by police. Other members of the nation are wounded. Malcolm X will go out to kind of call attention to that police brutality, to join with a kind of emerging United Front movement. Elijah Muhammad will call him out, will make him leave LA, but that's Malcolm X is there. And then 2 months later, Dr. King also shows up in LA and is talking about no compromise on this issue and talking about the need for kind of organizing black political strength to be able to have the political power to get rid of the police chief. So, okay, when you start to look at these things, that's in LA. We can get, if we go to New York, even earlier, Dr. King will describe his favorite union as 1199, Hospital and Healthcare Workers Union in New York. He gets introduced to them in 1959. They're organizing the lowest paid hospital workers in New York at the time. These are sort of Black and Puerto Rican women, like doing split sort of shifts, like kind of like orderlies. They have to strike to get recognition. They strike in 59. King supports it. They strike in 62. King supports it. But guess who else supports that strike in 62? Malcolm X. The only union Malcolm speaks in front of is 1199. And I could go on. Both King and Malcolm support the kind of protests around construction discrimination at Downstate in New York City. So when you look at what they're doing and what are the movements and issues they're working on, that difference gets a lot smaller, right? I'm not saying they're the same. I'm not saying they talk the same even about Northern liberalism, but both of them are calling to account the kind of and using the word hypocrisy of Northern liberalism. And we want to remember for King, that's a religion, hypocrisy is religious, right? It's this idea that first, before, just to quote the scripture, right, before you talk about the splinter in your neighbor's eye, you got to get rid of the plank in your own eye, right? So this notion of hypocrisy. Malcolm will talk about hypocrisy too, right? They don't talk in the same way, but the kind of commonalities of what issues they're working on and what movements they're supporting, right? We can see a lot of overlap. And Coretta Scott King, and we could talk about her for a minute.
Yeah, we're actually, let me interrupt there and say we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, that's exactly who we're going to talk about, Coretta Scott King. The book is The King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside of the South. Jean Theo Harris is the author and my guest. We're going to take a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today on this encore edition of Midday, we're talking about a recent book by the civil rights historian Jean Theo Harris. Drawing on previously untapped material from Coretta Scott King and others, Theo Harris chronicles how Martin Luther King Jr.'s crusade against discrimination in education, employment, housing, policing, and systemic racism extended well past the Jim Crow South. The book is called King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside of the South. Our show was recorded earlier, so we can't take any calls or online comments today. So Jean, Coretta Scott King, they meet in Boston in 1951. Dr. King is there. He's not doctor yet, but he's there studying to get his doctorate at BU, Boston University, over on Commonwealth Avenue. And across town on Massachusetts Avenue, is the New England Conservatory of Music, where Coretta Scott King is quite a gifted vocalist who's got a clear and abundant talent. She used that talent to support the movement by developing sort of freedom song concerts, fundraisers, modeled after Paul Robeson. After they're married for a while and, you know, Dr. King becomes the clear leader of the movement. Talk about what those events included.
So I sort of want to go back to their courtship, because I think one of the things we need to understand about Coretta Scott King is she's more of an activist than he is when they meet. She had gone to Antioch College in Ohio, and she gets introduced to the Progressive Party at Antioch. She's supporting, people may remember, the Progressive Party is running a third party challenge for the presidency in 1948. They're running Henry Wallace, both on a kind of anti-segregation platform domestically and on a kind of anti-Cold War militarism, right? So this, in some ways, these ideas that we associate with the last years of King's life, right? Racism, the trifecta or the triple evils of racism, poverty, and militarism, Coretta Scott King kind of already has the tendrils of, right, from that work in the Progressive Party. She's a student delegate to their convention, one of only 150 Black people who go to that convention, and she meets both Paul Robeson and Bayard Rustin before she meets Dr. King. So they meet in Boston, as you said, through a mutual friend. At first, she's kind of not sure she wants to go out with a minister, usually the kind of suits and sanctimony, right? She's not much for that. But they go out, their first date, like all dates, right? They talk about racism and capitalism. He's pretty odd, right? He's never met a woman like her. At the end of their date, he basically says, "You have all the qualities I want, you know, in a wife. You're, you know, beautiful, you're smart, you're perceptive, you're insightful." And she's like, "What? You don't even know me." So one of the things that I think, but she does agree to another date. And I think one of the things that we see is that Dr. King is going to have to bring his A game. And very much part of their emerging romance is that kind of political, intellectual, kind of, as you, the word you use, Tom, soulmate, right? Like that, there's a kind of kindredness there, right? She's really moved by the way that he, his vision of a ministry is about changing this country. She worries about whether being a minister's wife is going to make her life small. Her friends worry about whether he's going to amount to much. But after many months, she does want to marry him. They get married in June of 1953, but she refuses to wear white. She does not wear a long dress. She wears a T-length dress, and she makes her very imposing father-in-law, King Sr., take obey out of their vows because it makes her feel like an indentured servant. 1953, right? So this is who Martin Luther King marries, this kind of formidable, determined. And then, like you said, let's fast forward. Well, let me tell you one more story about, which I think is a really decisive moment in Montgomery, right? As we all know, the King's house gets bombed about 6 weeks in. Coretta and their new baby, two-month-old baby Yolanda, are home. She manages to get them out safely. But both of their dads show up that night and are angry and are terrified and are like, "You have to get out of here. And if you won't get out of here, at least Coretta and the baby have to get out of here." And she basically says no. And that's pretty extraordinary, right? And I think if we look at that moment, we see that kind of fierceness, what some friends and colleagues describe as being beyond steel. And that is gonna, that is gonna underline what Dr. King becomes in terms of his leadership, right? Is very much because of that beyond steel partner in Coretta Scott King.
And tell us about the documents in Coretta Scott King's hand that you used significantly in the course of this research that demonstrate the really strategic importance of Coretta to King and the movement.
So,
And that is an importance that heretofore really has not been fully recognized in your telling, right?
right. Yes, absolutely. And I think part of that stems from, and I, so Coretta Scott King, with Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, publishes an autobiography in 1969, a little more than a year after Martin Luther King is assassinated. And that comes about through, it turns out, a white woman editor at Holt, Reinhardt Winston, does the interviews and then gets a ghostwriter, a white man by the name of Alden Hatch, to write the book. So that's a little bit odd, right? That the writer doesn't even do the interviews. And then I realized that some of those interviews are available still in the papers that Alden Hatch donated to the University of Florida. And there's not, they're not, the transcripts aren't complete, but even what's there, she sounds very different than how she's rendered in the book. And it started to be like, what? And then I happened to find in those papers as well a folder that contains letters between Meyerson, the editor, and Hatch, the writer. The first letter that seems significant was Meyerson writing to Hatch. She's sending him the tapes of her interviews and the transcripts. And she says, I'm basically like, you'll notice that she, talks of a vast amount about herself. This is her autobiography. But it is urgent that this book be about him and not her. Wow, right? So this book is going to be published as an autobiography, but what Meyerson wants is for it to be about him, not her. And then she instructs this white man, Alden Hatch, that she wants it in a sentimental feminine tone like Reader's Digest. Okay. About 5 or 6 months later, he starts to show drafts of the book to Coretta and her sister, and Edith object. They object to the tone. They object to how much of their family's history has not made it into the book. And Hatch is mad about this, and he writes Meyerson and basically says, I wrote it purposefully with a simple tone that will, like, the critics will appreciate. We can think about what that might
Yeah,
mean.
the implications of that statement, right?
Yeah. And then he basically says, I need you to call in the big reserves and take her, and invite her to this, basically intimidate her to agreeing to this, right? And basically agreeing to the style. And largely that's what happens. And so we have this autobiography from 1969 that doesn't actually capture kind of Coretta Scott King and her ideas and her voice that then becomes sort of one of the public documents about her.
But the
And
tapes are a very different deal.
yeah, the tapes, and again, reading, there's about five tapes. It's not the whole thing, and there's some transcripts not of the tapes. But they just, like, she has a very different voice. It's much more contemplative, it's fiercer, there's different kinds of details. But again, when you see what Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston wanted versus kind of what she sounds like, right, there's a big, huge gap. And she will talk about over, like with so many people in the media and so many experiences that she feels like an attachment to a vacuum cleaner, right? First the wife of Martin and then the widow, right? And she's like, I'm so proud to be that, but I'm not just that, right? And so this sense of like not kind of getting also to be both her own person, but also her own politics. So just to tell you one more thing, her global activism, her anti-Vietnam activism actually begins before Dr. King's. She is out publicly on Vietnam years before Dr. King comes out publicly. I mean, again, he's privately opposed, right? But who is sort of doing the courageous, like being out there is Coretta Scott King. She's really leading the nation on this issue.
Yeah, and we think of that with Dr. King as happening at the speech at Riverside Church, which is 1967, actually a year to the day that he was killed a year later.
Exactly. And she's out years before that. She really sees, and she says this to him over and over, like when he gets the Nobel Prize, that this is a responsibility. They both now have a new responsibility and a broadened responsibility to the world. She talks about it also as a burden, in part because she feels this heavy responsibility to the world. And we will see her from the 1965 onward. She is out against the war in Vietnam consistently.
And when it comes to the relationship that they had, I mean, given the fact that, you know, the FBI surveilled Dr. King and we hear about his extramarital affairs, et cetera, how does that play into it? Because I know John Ige's biography, the most recent one, won the Pulitzer Prize a year ago or so, sort of concentrated on that to an extent. For example, the Taylor Branch's biographies of Dr. King did not. As we finish up here, how do those two things dovetail in the public imagination about Coretta and Martin and their relationship and the importance of Coretta to the movement in particular?
I mean, I think one of the unfortunate things about that is that it becomes a way not to see Coretta and to not take her fully seriously. One of the things I was really struck by in listening to her is how she talks about how Dr. King was a very good listener. And he didn't judge. And then I also talked to various gang members who had worked with him in 1966, 65, 67, and they talk about him as a great listener. And again, this idea of Dr. King, which we have from Coretta Scott King, from other friends like Harry Belafonte, from gang leaders in Chicago, that he's a great listener, again, falls out in kind of all this attention to, again, the more salacious materials.
Yeah. And of course, King as a great listener isn't surprising, but we don't think of him as a listener first. We think of him as a speaker first.
For sure, right?
Yeah. And just, you know, as you remind us, Coretta Scott King and her children went to Memphis just 4 days after Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis to show their support for the striking workers.
Imagine the courage and the fortitude.
Yeah.
Right?
Amazing. Jean Theo Harris, the book is called King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside of the South. Jean, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time and very much enjoyed reading the book as well.
Thanks so much for this conversation.
That's it for us today on this encore edition of Midday. I spoke with the civil rights historian Jean Theo Harris last April. Thanks for joining us on the radio and online. We hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and that you'll download the WIPR app so you can catch all of your favorite shows on demand. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.